Okay. So so this was something I came across just this week, and I figured I wanted to share it with you guys. So since Roy Ginsberg asked me this morning to fill the slot for Rich Haid, it was perfect to do it. So this is based on an article by Professor Rami Reiner, who's really excellent. He's an excellent medievalist. Most of what I've read of his in the past is Balia Tosfot material. It's very, very good. But he has an article on what he claims is essentially what looks like a halachic gemara, but he thinks is really on the line between halacha and agadah. And just last week, in honor of Purim, Elie Fisher translated his article and published it on the Lair House. So, and when Elie posted it, I'm like, oh, I should share this with you guys. So that's what we're going to do. So, so as he notes, there are passages in the Gemara, as we've seen many times, which are classic halachic Gemaras or classic agadah Gemaras. But in the past, we've talked about those that straddle between the two. And this is the very fascinating Gemara that he wants to pick up on. So you go to Gemara and Kuf Mem Tet Amud Aleph. The Gemara tells you a very weird story. The context of the Gemara is as follows. There is a person named Isar. Isar Giora. What is Isar Giora? So Giora is
convert,
and his name is Isar. Okay? Which, of course, is weird because his name means prohibition. Not sure what to do with that, but that's his name. So the Gemara tells you, has the following question. There's a halacha called Shchiv Meira. What's a Shchiv Meira? A Shchiv Meira is someone who's dying. He's on his deathbed. And because he's on his deathbed, we suspend the normal requirements for kinyan if he wants to give a gift to someone. He can just say, I'm giving this gift to someone, and it works. So the Gemara says, what happens if he's modeh? He doesn't give a gift. He rather says, I admit on my deathbed that I owe money to such and such. Does that count? That we have to now respect that claim, and therefore the money is taken from the heirs and given to the person he claims he owes money to. Okay? So the Gemara tries to bring the proof from the following very weird story. Tashma, the Iser Giora, Havale, Tracer Alfe Zuze, Beirav. Iser Giora had left 12,000 zuz with Rava. Okay? Just in time, Adam. Right, so this convert named Isar had left his property, he had left 12,000 zuz at Rava's house. Right, Rava was the shomer. He had a son named Rav Mari Bray, right, his son wasn't Bray. Bray means his son. His son's name is Rav Mari. Horato shelo b'kdusha v'leidato b'kdusha avai. He was conceived before Isar had converted, and was born after Isar had converted. After his mother had converted. Right? Uberav Hafe. Okay. Now, why is that relevant? Because since he was conceived before his mother converted, so therefore is he halachically Isar's son? No. Right, halachically, he is not his son because since Isar and his wife converted while she was pregnant, and the halacha is that Gershin is Gayer, Kikatan Shinola Dami, that when you convert, you're like a child, you're like a newborn, so then they're not related. Now, if that's the case, there are no heirs, which means that the money, what's the rule when a ger has no heirs? What happens to the property? Kol ha-kodem zacha. Anyone who gets it first gets it. It's hefker. So the first person who gets it owns it. Right? The ger, if he actually has no relatives, So then the money is hefker, anyone who wants to take it can take it, yes. One second. Right? That's only certain types of property. Right? But this money would go, right, to whoever had them first. Now, what the issue here is that since the money is already at Rava's house, land, you're right, Adam. But this is the money. But now what's the problem? The money is at Rava's house. So if the property is going to go to whoever grabs it first, but the money is already in Rava's possession, then as soon as Isser dies, if Rav Mari is not his son, then who gets the money? Rava. Very good. So now, Amar Rava, Heichi nak nikninhu, Rav Mare lahani zuze. So now they try to figure out, is there any way that the money can go to Rav Mari? Because obviously, even though halachically Rav Mari may not be Isser's son, he is his son. Right? He is his son. And therefore he wants to bequeath his property to Rav Mari. So Rava says, can we do it? Ibi Arusha, if you want to give it to him through inheritance, Lav Bar Yerushahu. He is not his heir. So then someone says, what about Ibn Matana? Why doesn't he give it to him as a present? What's the problem? So Matna Shiv Meira, Rava tells you, is conceptualized, right? The Matana that we just said, that on someone's deathbed, they can bequeath something without a kinyan. That is a Dirabanan expansion of Yerusha. Therefore, Matna Shiv Meira ki Yerusha Shavir Rabanan. You can only do it if the formal laws of inheritance apply, because since the convert has no lawful heirs, therefore, he can't utilize the mechanism of Matna Shiv Meira. Kol Heiche de Ite B'Yerusha, Ite B'Matana, if he's capable of bequeathing things through inheritance. So Ite B'Matana, he can give a Matna Shiv Meira. Kol Heiche de Lete B'Yerusha, Lete B'Matana. So then someone says, even Mashiach, why don't you let Rav Mari actually take them physically? What's the problem? Letnu Gabe. It's not here. The money's at Rava's house, and Isser is dying not at Rava's house. Ibe Chalipin. So what's your next alternative? What's King Chalipin? Right, King and Sudar. So Rava says, no, ain't my van nigne b'chalipin. Money cannot be acquired through symbolic transfer.
Why not?
Because it can't. Fine. Iagav karaka. So why don't you use kinyan agav? What's kinyan agav? So can you... With land. Specifically land, right? Is that if I sell Sean land, I sell him a house, I could give him the furniture with the house. I don't have to do a separate kinyan. He can do a kinyan agav. He does a kinyan on the house, and everything in it can go with it. So he says, why don't you do that? He says, let le'ara. He doesn't have land. So until this point in the Gemara, remember the situation. Rava stands to gain a fortune of money. Because if they can't find a legal mechanism for Rav Mari to acquire the property, then it stays with Rava because it's in his house right now. So now, in the court, they keep raising suggestions of how they could let Isser give the money to Rav Mari, and Rava keeps shooting them down. So at this point, we have a suffix in our minds. Why is Rava shooting it down? Possibility one is he wants the money. Possibility two is he thinks there's actually a problem. So how would we figure out whether Rava is trying to find a way to keep the money for himself, or in fact, just thinks that all these suggestions don't work. Basically, we put him in a situation where it definitely works and Rava chooses not to. So that's what the Gemara then does. The Gemara says, aha, ibe ma machlashtan. So there's a special kinyan called ma machlashtan, which means that if you you do verbal instruction in the presence of three parties, meaning the current custodian, the original owner, and the final target, Ma'amad Shlashtan, all three relevant parties, so then you can do a verbal transfer. So that's a great solution, right? So Rava answers, Ishalach li lo azilna. Great, but if he asks me to show up, I'm not showing up. That would work, but I'm not coming. Right? So now, our worst suspicions have been validated, because the first five suggestions we thought, well, maybe it just worked out for Rava that he happened to think that halachically there was no possible way for him to give property to Rav Mari, but now the Gemara says, aha, there's a good solution, which is Rava, Rav Mari, and Isar have to be in the same room, and then Isar can verbally transfer the property to Rav Mari. And now Rava says, nope, I'm not showing up. I am not showing up. So as, right, in Eli Fisher's suggestion, our suspicions are confirmed. Rava, one of the most prominent, outstanding sages of the Talmud, is depicted by the Talmud itself as being completely rapacious. So then it gets worse. You think it couldn't get worse? It did. You skip down to three lines. Adahachi. V'liknenu be'odita. So the Gemara, remember how we got into this whole discussion? The Gemara said, is a Shchid Mira allowed to make an admission that he owes someone money? So what happened? The suggestion was made that they use an Odita. What's an Odita? Where Rav Mari, or Isa rather, will claim in front of a court that he owes 12,000 zuz to Rav Mari. And therefore, when he dies, you'll have to go to Rav Mari, because even though before it goes to Hefker, you have to pay off his debts. And therefore, what we'll do is we'll create a chob, we'll create a debt, and the money, right, an imaginary debt, which will now be paid off and be given to Rav Mari. And what does Rava respond? Adahachi nafig odidim b'isar. So that's what they did. Ikbid Rava. Rava got angry. Amar kam megamrei tananda leinje umafsedeli. You're teaching people legal claims that make me lose money. Okay? And that's the end of the Gemara. That is the end of the Sugya. So Rami Reiner says, what are we to make of this passage? Is it a formalistic discussion of the laws of inheritance and methods of acquisition? Is it a barely concealed critique of one of the Talmud's most important sages? Is its lesson that no one, not even Rava, is immune from having his judgment affected by personal interests? Or that no one is above warranted criticism? So here what he does is he says, you missed the point. You missed the point. Perhaps both the formalistic and critical readings of this passage missed the point. Meaning one way of reading this is to say, this is purely a halachic gemara. It's just teaching us the law, and it's saying, you're right, you can't use a kinyan sudar, and you need land for an agav, and odita will work. Aha, we learned odita works. Shchid Meira can admit the money. Possibility two is that no, this is really just an agadic passage that is teaching you that even the great Rava can be greedy, and you can't trust people when their own money is involved, right, etc. Or you say that you've totally missed the genre of what's going on. And that's what Rami Reiner suggests. He says, it seems to me that the right way to read it, and others like it, is as a comedy. Right? This is not, it's not a halachic piece, but it's not a purely agadic piece, right? Definitely not a purely agadic piece that's coming to be critical. It is a halachic comedy. It's, we should be alert to its sarcastic, ironic, and even borderline grotesque elements. In such a reading, Rav'ika was not needed to save us from obvious injustice, and Rava is depicted not as a boundlessly greedy money grubber, but as a comic actor in a performance that he stages by Esar's deathbed. How does that work? So he says, let's remind ourselves where we are. Right? Where is this sugya? As we said, it's in the middle of the discussion of Shchiv Meira. What's the discussion of Shchiv Meira? That if someone's on his deathbed, we withdraw some of the limitations of the formalized halachic system to his giving over property. So that's the background for this. Okay? So now he says, so what's the comedy? Rava, the sole actor in the theater of the absurd that he stages by Yisra's deathbed, illustrates just how farcical it is to conduct a formalistic legal monetary debate at which Rava, the great sage, normally excels at such a time. Meaning, if you imagine this, right, we were all caught up in this and we were thinking about, oh, Rava's greedy, right? But we missed the scene, right? To understand the scene, Rami Reiner argues, you have to imagine the scene. The gadol of the Amoraim is there as someone's dying on his bed, and there's a bunch of people there, apparently, who are, oh, Rava has some of Esar's money, and they want to get it to his son, who's his biological son and emotionally his son, but is not formally his son, so he wants to inherit it. How are we going to do it? And it's like, the guys who've been in yeshiva for way too many years, that like they miss the point that there's a guy dying here on his deathbed, like now is not the time. So what happens? The yeshiva guys there say, right, Rav'ika runs in and he says, oh, Esar, you're dying. How are we going to get it? Should we do a kinyan? Should we let you inherit? No, cut down this, right? You're a convert, could cut into no lodami. Okay, how about we use a matnas shiv meira? No! Oh, it's a halachic extension of the category of Yerusha. Oh, that doesn't work because he doesn't have Yerusha. Fine. How about agav? Oh, that would work, but he doesn't have land. Okay, how about sudar? No, that doesn't work on money, right? Oh, mama shlashtan, right? And Rava just, right, and they're going back and forth, right, and finally Rav'ika says, I got it! Let's create an imaginary loan between the father and his biological son, which will create a debt which will have to be paid after death, right? And Rava is standing there, right? And this is how he writes it. The goal of Rava's theatrics is didactic. He aims to show how ridiculous such formal discussions are when a person, a righteous convert like Esar, is dying. Rav'ika, who rushes to Esar's house and suggested a formal confession as a solution, thought he was resolving this ethical legal quagmire. But in Rava's eyes, Rav'ika is a manifestation of the problem, not its solution. The only words that Rav'ika can utter as he approaches the bedside of the dying Esar are legalistic formulae, right? Aha, Esar, you're dying, I have a solution! The last thing I want you to say before you die to your son is, I have an imaginary loan to you of 12,000 zuz. Rava's outburst, which concludes the passage, is not about Rav'ika's advice to Esar, but about the very notion that this is what is important at the most significant moments of someone's life or death. According to the naive reading, Rava is rapacious, and Rav'ika's ethical vision triumphs over injustice. Now, it turns out, that Rabbi Ika is trapped within a world of legalistic Talmudic terminology, unable to grasp the piercing irony and bitter sarcasm underlying Rava's critique of engaging in halachic discussion at such a time. Rabbi Ika is not the only one caught in the formalistic trap of halachic law. Over time, this passage becomes the cornerstone of the laws of inheritance for converts, with all its harsh halachic ramifications. Based on this passage, Rabbeinu Tam, and if you look at it here, right, one of the leading Tosafists concludes that not only are converts not subject to the laws of inheritance and bequests, not only unable to will their assets to the vehicle of Matnas Shchiv Mira, but even the Talmudic principle that is a mitzvah to uphold the instructions of the deceased, right, mitzvah Shmuel Divrei Amei, does not apply to instructions issued by the convert. The whole gist of this principle is it is a mitzvah to uphold the instructions of the deceased, is to tell the dying, focus on substance, not the details, for we, the living, promise to execute your wishes regardless of this or that legal formality. And yet, in Rabbeinu Tam's hands, it becomes just another detail within a tightly woven web of legalistic minutiae. Rabbeinu Tam and many other interpreters of the Talmud in his wake read this passage with customary gravitas for reading, studying, interpreting, and inferring practical conclusions from the Talmudic passages. This aligns completely with the trend which began in the Gaon era to isolate the legal elements of the Talmud and read them using only legal interpretive techniques. However, the gates of interpretation are never closed, and every generation develops new methods for reading and interpreting the Talmud. We've suggested that this passage and others like it demand a reading that is open to the possibility of irony, sarcasm, didactic humor, and other heretofore unexplored modes. Read in this way, the passage is not quite so grim, and its implications not only reflect on the developing world of halakha, but also enrich our understanding of its modes of discourses, and consequently, of the eternal truths contained within the Torah. Right? So what Reiner's argument is that the proper way to read this Gemara, right, is not purely halachic and not purely agadic, but, right, exactly, right, is a comedy which is meant to teach a point in which halachic argumentation is the material of the comedy, right? And that what it is, right, essentially a scene in which the least appropriate thing to possibly do is have a full-out shirkoli on exactly how, right, Isser is dying. The last, right, what he should be thinking of now is what does he want to leave his family as he's dying? Not what lumdish category can I come up with to get the money to my son, who I treat as my son, but halachically, not, I mean, right? Rav Ika, according to his read, totally misses that point, right? He's just like, oh, a halachic shaila came up, the fact that there's a human being dying here flees his mind. And Rava, by being, as he says, like, almost grotesque in the way that he, like, puts his personal interests on it, right? Like, I won't show up for it, right? Rather than saying I won't show up for it because I want the money, it's like, that's not the point, right? That Rava is the one who basically uses irony to highlight that this is not what we should be talking about here, right? Now, I don't know if I would go as far as Rami Reiner, which is to say, and therefore you can't learn halachic conclusions from this Gemara, right? That's essentially what he says, which is maybe this Gemara isn't meant to be halachic, and therefore we can't derive things from it. I'm not sure that's true, right? Maybe you can. Maybe it's both halachic and comedic, and I don't know, right? So I'm not 100% sold on this point. But the fact that you can neither take this as fully halachic, nor look at this Gemara and say, okay, let's take it at face value and learn that Rava is extremely greedy, and the Gemara is just happily celebrating Rava's greed, the fact that there must be something else going on here, I am convinced of, right? And to say that this is some sort of melding of satire and comedy and halacha all together, where the real point of the Gemara is to say, don't, right, take a step out and, you know, I remember Maidan once gave this in Shirkoli, right, where, like, we get so desensitized sometimes that, like, you're reading, you know, like, you're learning Yevamo the whole year, and you never stop to think that the entire Masechta is about someone who dies young, probably, childless, right? Right? Instead, we, like, and, like, it's important to someone to step out of the Gemara just for a second and remember that, like, when you're there figuring out, right, like, we all love Yavamos. Oh, what? Once you say that the type of intercourse that will be makna the husband to the wife, or the wife to the husband, rather, is a ra'a, and you don't need kavana. So what if somebody falls without clothes off the roof and lands inside the, there's actually a case in the Gemara, right? This is an actual case. Right? And in Lumdus, everyone's like, oh, you see ha'ara'a without kavana. And it's like, okay, can you just think for a minute about the fact that we're talking about a young wife whose husband died, and now her brother-in-law falls off the roof and accidentally sleeps with her, have, like, traumatic, like, you just need some, at some point in the environment has to, like, step out and say, right? And what Reiner is saying is that sometimes Gemar does that. Right, that through a little bit of humor and a little bit of irony, remember we did this a little bit with the Makot murder thing, right? Sometimes Gemara pushes you just to remind you there are actual people here, right? And law, it's very nice in yeshiva to, like, get through all the lumdos, but if you don't imagine what that moment looks like when it's being implemented, you miss part of it because halacha takes place in real life. And you need to remember that. You need to be sensitive. And sometimes the only way to do that is to shock you out of your complacency with just a little bit of over-the-top comedy, satire, whatever. And therefore, I do buy his argument that the Gemara isn't trying to teach you that Rava is greedy, right? That another way of looking at Rava is that Rava is sort of expressing himself in shocking ways to shock you out of, right, complacency, right? To shock you out of being, you know, like, if you're talking about someone who's dying, the first thing you have to remember about Matan Shchiv Meira is what it looks like, is a person on his deathbed. Like, yes, it's important that we know the legal mechanism, but that's always what it's going to look like. And that should affect what you think about.
And what better person to illustrate this point than the person who would be
that? Exactly, and that's exactly the point. That to put this in the mouth of Rava, who is the hero of Talmudic dialectic, right, is a good way of highlighting that even Rava can realize there's more to life than you know, lumdus. Yeah, right, and that's exactly the point. And therefore, I do think it's a very powerful way. Again, I'm not, his point that maybe that should affect the extent to which we accept the halakhic conclusions of Gemara, that I don't know, right? That I'm not necessarily willing to say, but to say that there are clearly satirical elements here that are supposed to shake us from our complacency. And remember that this is a deathbed scene, right? And that in deathbed scenes, you care about the person dying, right? And not the lumdus, right? That I am willing to buy, so when I saw it, I figured it was worth sharing. It's a fun little treatment of the sugya, so we'll call that.